would you grab your Bibles and open to the book of Ruth? We will eventually get to chapter 4 today, but we are going to start in Ruth chapter 1. Often when Rob and I are thinking about how we're going to do sermon series, we plan out what we're going to cover, often based on what we think would be appropriate for sort of the needs and the state of the church at the time. And that's been the case for series like Ephesians and Matthew and some of the others. I have to confess to you that when I chose the book of Ruth, here was the reasoning. I had 4 weeks and there were 4 chapters. Isn't that spiritual? That's awesome. And I have to admit that I chose it for no other reason than I wanted to do something Old Testament. It was not particularly because this book really grabbed me or captured me. In fact, it's always been sort of one of the, okay, read it and then kind of move on. It never got me until I started studying it for this series. And I have to admit that since starting it 4 weeks ago, I have just been absolutely captured by this book and this story. I think the picture of God in this story is absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. I think that the depth of the characters that we see is just wonderful. I think that the crisis and the resourcefulness of these women is just amazing. And I think that the way that God weaves his own work in with sort of the human condition and their own decision making, and neither one of them sort of trumps the other, and God still seems to work this thing out, is just amazing. I think that it's a message that we actually really need to hear when we often sort of wonder, what does my story have to do with anything bigger than me? And where is God actually at work? I think that this story shows us problems and despair and hope. I think this, we can very much find some key points to touch down on and see, yeah, I can be in this story. This is actually about me too. But more than it being about me or you, this is about God. And the like I said, the picture of God in this story is just awesome. So please join me. We are going to start in Ruth chapter 1, and we are going to be moving, because I can't preach Ruth 4 without talking about 1 to 3, because just the story is so intricately connected between the chapters. So it's just one story. And so in order to finish the story, we got to start it all over again. We saw in chapter 1 that this story starts in the time of the book of Judges, the time of the judges, the time of stupid people doing stupid things over and over again, and the people of God spiraling out of control. Has your life ever spiraled out of control? And somehow still God can touch down in the midst of it. We see that there has been a famine in the land of God's people, a famine in Israel, a famine in Bethlehem. And we reminded ourselves that Bethlehem, the name Bethlehem means house of bread. And there's a famine in the house of bread. What is going on? We see one particular family that makes a particularly bad move. Elimelech moves from the house of bread because he thinks he's going to find bread somewhere else. And he goes to the land of God's enemies, the enemies of his people, the land of Moab. And it just continues the downward spiral from there. Elimelech dies, and then his two sons die as well after having married women from that land. And three women, Naomi and her two daughters-in-law, are left destitute. Vulnerable, incredibly vulnerable. And we've talked about this a number of times throughout this series, that women in this day were particularly vulnerable. Not because women are weak. It's actually because society had structured it so that women were left vulnerable. And we had to look at this text and say, what is happening in this text is not necessarily ought. It's not the way it ought to have been. But God works among the situation that he finds his people dealing with. And so is does not equal ought. And there's a lot of patriarchy that we have to sort of scratch our heads and go, is this the way it should have been in this text? And we have to wrestle with that a little bit. But these women are left vulnerable. And Naomi and her daughters-in-law, left in Moab without any protection because there was no man in their life at the moment, Naomi decides that she's going to try and return to Bethlehem. She makes about a 50-mile journey, roughly from Wetaskiwin to Red Deer, on foot. It's incredibly dangerous. But she's heard that God has sent food to Bethlehem again, to the house of bread. And so she says, I'm better off there than I am staying here. And so they start to make the move. And as they are going, Naomi encourages her two Moabite daughters-in-law to stay in Moab. And you got to look at why she tells them that she thinks that they should stay. She tells them to stay because they will be safer in Moab and provided for among their own family and their own sort of wider social circles. They will get to maintain their own religion and language and people and everything that they have known. She says, it'll be better for you if you don't come with me. And in spite of the fact that the two of them have started to accompany her back, Orpah, one daughter-in-law, decides, no, I think you're actually right, and I should go back to Moab. And she does, and there's nothing wrong with that. Orpah listens to the advice of her mother-in-law. She is not a bad person for having done this. There are actually no bad people in this book, other than maybe Elimelech, in this book. She doesn't do as good of a job as we see Ruth doing, because Ruth decides, no, I heed your warning, and I'm still going to follow you instead. And so Ruth accompanies Naomi back. She makes this for better or worse promise. Even though I'm going to be way worse off if I stick with you, Naomi, I can't leave you alone. And so she makes this for better or for worse, till death do us part promise, to her mother-in-law. And she accompanies her back to Bethlehem. And Naomi doesn't really seem to appreciate it at the time. She doesn't. In fact, when Naomi and Ruth get back to Bethlehem and she reconnects with the people of the village, she's talking to them about how God has brought me back empty. We shouldn't diminish that, because she came back pretty, pretty low, having just lost a husband and two sons. But she didn't come back completely empty, because Ruth is there. Though at the moment, Naomi doesn't really recognize or acknowledge the sacrifice that Ruth is making, and she also doesn't see how well this is going to benefit her down the road in the story. We reflected on chapter one, and we talked about how God is like a chess player sometimes, and there are just moves that you see being made that you don't understand how that could possibly be part of any bigger strategy than just the move that you see at the moment. And we have to reflect on that in terms of our own lives, that often there are just things happening out there that God may be involved in, but it might look like it has absolutely nothing to do with you at all. But maybe it does. Maybe God is still at work as part of your story, but you can't see it at the moment. Sometimes we are exactly like Ruth and Naomi. We entered into Ruth chapter 2, and we started talking about the prospects that these women have. They're now back in Bethlehem, but they are still destitute. We talked about the options that women have at this particular time because of the culture and the way that society had structured itself. Women have two basic options at this time. They can beg, or they can sell themselves into slavery, which would therefore mean probably prostitution. But there's one more thing. We talked about in chapter 1, there's another seed of hope, both that Ruth has promised to Naomi that she's going to look after her, and that they show up at the time of the barley harvest. Someone asked me why I'd mentioned the barley harvest in chapter 1. They're like, is that because you like beer? I'm like, no, that's just a happy coincidence, actually. But they show up at the time of the barley harvest. Bethlehem, start of the barley harvest. And there's a third option that women have when it comes to the options available to them if they don't have a man in their lives to look after them at the moment, and that is gleaning at the time of the harvest. It basically means that you end up following the people who are harvesting, the men who are harvesting. The poorest people, especially the women, can follow along behind the harvesters and pick up whatever it is that they drop. That's their only other option, and it only occurs at the time of the harvest. And it just so happens that they have turned up at the right time. Another happy coincidence. And it's going to be a game changer for them. And now Ruth is going to make good on her promise. Ruth had said, I'm going to look after you, Naomi. I'm going to stick with you. And Ruth is smart enough to put the pieces together and realize, I've got crummies in my tummy at the moment. I'm hungry. I need to eat. Therefore, I need to have money or go find food. Therefore, I am going to go work. And Naomi goes, okay, you should go do that. And Ruth, in spite of that not great attitude at the moment from Naomi, Ruth says, I'm still going to stick by you, and I'm going to go out and do this. And she does. And she does the back-breaking work of creeping along through fields all day long, picking up small pieces of grain and small stalks that the reapers have left behind because they've dropped. And Ruth is such a hard worker that by the end of the day of doing that, she has 40 pounds of barley that she has managed to gather. One of the reasons why she's managed to gather that much is not just because she's a hard worker, but also because Boaz, the guy who owns the field, has shown up at the same time, just by coincidence. It just happened to be the case. In fact, that's what the Hebrew says. It's got this funny little phrase. You may see it in your translations, you might not, where it says, it just happened to be the case that Boaz showed up at that time to check on how the work in his field was going. He's the owner, and he's coming to check on his workers. And he just so happens to then notice Ruth, and he asks someone, who's that? Who's the new girl? And he gets filled in on who exactly this is. And he goes, I know who she is. And he goes over to talk to her. And he says, your reputation has preceded you. I know who you are. I know what you have done for Naomi. I know the sacrifice that you made. You left everything behind in Moab. Your people, your religion, your language and culture, absolutely everything that you knew, because you decided to stick it out for this person, and I'm going to honor you for that. That's what Boaz does for her. So he gives her three things. First of all, he gives her protection. And I do want to once again just make explicit that the book of Ruth says at least six times that women in this particular culture were particularly vulnerable, even in public. And so Boaz makes it explicit. He says, I've told those other workers out in the field not to touch you. He offers her protection that she did not otherwise have. He not only offers her protection, he recognizes that she's destitute, and he offers her lunch, realizing she didn't bring a bag lunch with her because she doesn't have anything in the cupboard at home. He offers her provision. And then he tells his workers, not only don't touch her, but as you're harvesting and you're binding up all of the stalks or the grain or whatever it is, you know what? You've probably gathered too much and you haven't dropped enough, so pull out some of the stuff that you worked so hard for and drop it back down to make sure that she gets more than what she needs. Boaz is going way out of his way to make sure that Ruth and Naomi are provided for. Ruth sees that he's done this, and they're in conversation, and she goes, why are you doing this? Like, I don't deserve this. I'm a foreigner. You don't even know me. And he tells her he's doing this because of what she has done for Naomi, and he's heard about it, and he admires the character that he has seen in her. Further to that, he says, you have sought refuge. This is Chapter 2, verse 12, you may want to look at this. You've sought refuge under Yahweh's wings, so may he reward you. That's going to be really important in about 5 minutes. First, though, I want you to notice what we reflected on what it is that these two noticed in each other. In Boaz, Ruth recognizes that he has compassion on people, the least of these. He offers her protection. He is generous with what he has. And his kindness goes way beyond the call of duty at that time. And in Ruth, Boaz recognizes hard work. He notices loyalty and commitment to someone that she did not have to make that commitment to. He notices character, compassion as well. He notices that she's got a good reputation. Her reputation has preceded her because he heard about her from the village, and he heard that she had stuck by Naomi and that people were saying good things about this Ruth person. We reflected on that, and then we reflected on these coincidences that we saw, that the text actually makes explicit. It doesn't say God did this. It just says, and it just so happened that. And this was the case. It just so happened that Ruth went to Boaz's field. His wasn't the only field around. And she just happens to decide to go work there, not having heard about this guy, not having known who he was. She just happens to show up there. And Boaz just happens to leave Bethlehem and go out to his field to check it out and see how it's going while Ruth's working. And he just happens to notice her, the person that he just happens to have heard about. Some coincidences. So we reflected on these coincidences, and I told you two stories. I'm not going to tell you them now. You can go back and listen to it. Two stories. Sometimes coincidences are nothing more than coincidences. And other times, as this text seems to be indicating, they are part of God working something behind the scenes. God, that chess player again, making these moves that we don't really understand at the time, but we start lining them up and we go, man, are you in this? We don't maybe get the full strategy, but we see God at work. And that's what's happening in this text again. Then we get to Ruth chapter 3. By the time we're in Ruth chapter 3, some time has passed. We have moved through the barley harvest, which is 4 to 6 weeks. Then we've moved through the wheat harvest, which comes immediately after it, another 4 to 6 weeks. And now they're at the stage of winnowing, which basically means they're processing all of the things that they have harvested. They're processing their grain. Naomi recognizes that though Ruth has been able to get this part-time job at in Boaz's field over the last number of weeks, that's now over, which means the supplies in the cupboard are now starting to go down, and the fridge is starting to look a little bit more bare, and Naomi can put the pieces together, and she goes, we don't have any more prospects now once gleaning is done. So what are we going to do? Well, she comes up with a plan. Please look at Naomi's words carefully here, because some people read this and go, I'm going to attribute to Naomi less than noble motivations for it. If you're going to attribute less than noble motivations to what Naomi tells Ruth to do here, that's just guesswork unless you can find some evidence in the text. And in the text, it says explicitly that Naomi suggests this plan to Ruth because she has Ruth's best interest in mind. She says in, I think it's verse 1 or verse 2, I have to make sure that you have security. Your text may say rest. Once again, that's rest with the understanding you can only rest because you are safe and secure. I have to seek security for you long term. So here's a plan. You know Boaz? Boaz isn't just a good guy with a good reputation. He's also part of our wider circle of family members who have a certain responsibility towards us. And so here's what I want you to do. Boaz is working down. He's processing his grain right now down at the threshing floor. The threshing floor was a place outside in a field where a whole bunch of men worked to process their grain. I'm not going to go through how they process it, but they're sleeping there at night in order to guard their harvest, to guard their investment. Boaz is going to be eating and drinking there tonight. Then he's going to nod off and go to sleep. I want you to go there when it's close to being dark out. She's sending this vulnerable girl out into the dark, into the fields, to go at night and see where he's sleeping. Once you see where he's sleeping, wait till he's fast asleep. And here's what I want you to do, she says. I want you to go over to him, lay down next to where this guy is sleeping, and lift the edge of his robe and uncover his feet. We talked about last week, I'm not going to go into it, whether feet means feet or whether feet means a little further north. And I'm not going to go into exactly what that might mean. You can go back and listen to that message. Either way, it's very, very risky. And that risk shows how absolutely desperate these two women are. What are their other options? They can't come up with any. So they're making a desperate move here. It's risky not only because this is a young woman going out at night into basically the bed of her boss. It's risky because she could be taken advantage of. And if she is, she has zero legal recourse. She has nothing. She's a foreigner. She's not even Israelite. She has no legal protection at all if she were taken advantage of. Further to that, the threshing floor was not just a place where men worked. It was also a place where the prostitutes knew that they could make more money. And that's not hypothetical. That's found in other scriptures. The book of Hosea, for example. It's also risky because even say Boaz is the righteous person, the good person that so far we have seen him to be in this text, he could very well interpret what she is doing at the moment as though she has less than noble intentions. It could be basically he interpreting it to be seduction, with the hope of getting her hands in his pockets and getting something out of it. This is an incredibly, incredibly risky move. And further to that, it's left pretty ambiguous in the Hebrew as to what exactly she uncovers, what Naomi is telling her to uncover, and then what's going on in Ruth's mind about what it is that she uncovers. It's just not clear. It's intentionally not clear, I would say. Ruth recognizes that this is their best chance for survival, and she's promised to take care of Naomi, and out of loyalty to Naomi, she goes. She goes through with the plan. Naomi tells her, go uncover his feet, and then he will tell you what to do. Well, Ruth goes down there, does what she says, but then Boaz says, who is it? It's dark. They don't have electric lights. He sees that there's a shape of a woman at his feet, and he doesn't know who this is, and he says, who's there? Who is this? And she says, it's Ruth, and now I'm going to tell you what to do. I like that. That's cool. Here's what I want you to do, she says. Rob, are you here? Front and center. I never look right here, sorry. I love this. I mentioned this last week. This is a three-way pun, what she says. So you're going to like this. Ruth gives instructions to Boaz, and it's got a pun. It's got a really complex pun. She tells Boaz to spread his wing over top of her. And the Hebrew word just doesn't have a one-to-one translation for English because it's a pun. It both means the edge of a robe, and she has just lifted the edge of his robe. We don't know how far, but she lifted it. He's woken up. She says, spread your wing over me. Does that mean his garment? It also means wing, like as in the wing of a bird, which often is used as a metaphor in Hebrew, and we find it in some of our worship songs, like, I find my strength in the shelter of your wings. It's a metaphor for protection. It's the picture of a mother hen hiding safely her chicks under her wing. That's the first and the second part of the pun. But the third part of the pun is what I mentioned to you 5 minutes ago where I said that you need to remember this line from chapter 2, verse 12, where Boaz tells her that she has sought protection under the wings of Yahweh. May she be rewarded. And she uses his words against him. It's awesome. It's absolutely brilliant what she does. Absolutely brilliant. Because she is essentially telling him that he should be the answer to the prayer he prayed on her behalf. You get that? She uses his words against him. Three-way pun. It's just amazing. I'm so glad you're here for this, Rob. And it is explicitly a request for marriage. And notice his response. He applauds her. And what does he say? This next act of loyalty is even better than your first. It's not loyalty to Boaz. She's not loyal to him. She has no reason to be loyal to him. It's loyalty to Naomi. Her first act of loyalty to Naomi was when she made her for better or for worse promise and has followed through on it the whole way. And now she makes this second act, and it's an act of loyalty because this is the only way that Naomi can be provided for long term. Because Boaz is part of that wider family circle. And if Ruth marries Boaz, then Boaz has a responsibility to take care not only of Ruth, but Naomi as well. But if Ruth marries some Joe Schmo from down the road who is not related to Naomi, Ruth goes into the home and family of that new person, and Naomi is left in the cold because that new person would have zero responsibility to take care of Naomi long term. This is an act of loyalty. And Boaz recognizes it. And he says, this is even better than the first. And I applaud you for it. And he agrees to the plan. We reflected on this text, and we said sometimes God needs to answer our prayers for others through us. She throws his words back at him and challenges him to make good on what he just talked about earlier. Prayed on her behalf. Sometimes we need to pray for others, but then we also need to ask God if he's going to be answering that prayer through us. we also reflected on this and said, this is a really, really sexually charged scenario. Just incredibly so. She perfumes herself. She goes down to his bed. It's where the prostitutes work. She's incredibly vulnerable. She's making a marriage proposal. And in spite of all that, as far as we can see in the text, these characters make it through it with integrity. He could have taken advantage of her. He didn't. The reason why it seems to be described as such a sexually ambiguous scenario, it seems to me, is to highlight the way that the characters actually move through this story. And in spite of all of the odds stacked against them, they walk through it with the same amount of character that they demonstrated everywhere else in the story up to that point. One thing that we did not reflect on, because it's not mentioned in this text, I've been using this image of God as the chess player. I didn't mention it when we talked about Ruth chapter 3, and that's intentional, because God is not mentioned or even hinted at being involved in this particular scenario. This just seems to be three human beings working out a plan based on the best stuff that they have available at the moment. And you know what? That's not a bad thing, because that's where you and I live most of our lives. We don't often get directions directly from God, do we? Oftentimes, what we have to do is simply make the best of the situation that we have, and we hope and pray that based on what we have, God is going to honor the decisions that we make and work through the situation in spite of it not being necessarily the best. They simply make the best of it, and God seems to answer that and honor that. I like that. We also talked last week about what this text is not about. Like, it's not about a command to women to go and make yourself pretty and do whatever he says. We can't simply cut and paste from their world into ours and go, yeah, that's what this is talking about. No, this is simply presenting what was the case. It is does not automatically equal ought. There are more steps that you need to involve in that process. So please don't click, drag, and drop. Don't click, drag, and drop the patriarchy. We talked about that last week. Lastly, it's not a text about romance. Like, I'm sorry to rob you of some of that, because I know that some people love this because it's sort of like a biblical rom-com. And like, I'm sorry, it's just not. Like, this text is about survival. And Naomi makes it explicit. This is not about romance budding between Boaz and Ruth that Naomi feels like she needs to capitalize on. This is Naomi's words are, I have to seek security for you. Boaz recognizes that this is about security and loyalty and long-term hope for Naomi, and that's why Ruth does it. It's not that there couldn't be romance there, it's just not made explicit. I think it's actually something more important than romance. It's about looking out for the other people. But at the end of chapter 3, we're left hanging. What's going to happen? Boaz has agreed to this plan, but he says there's a problem. There's a guy ahead of me in line. He's got the right of first refusal, whatever it is. There's a guy ahead of me. So chapter 4, Boaz says, I'm going to do what you've asked. I'm going to go to the gate. This is where decisions are made. So he goes to the gate, and so-and-so, the guy who's first in line, isn't given a name. It's basically, the Hebrew is sort of our version of so-and-so. So-and-so shows up. He's the guy that's first in line. And the text once again uses that same phrase that it used in chapter 2, where it just so happened to be the case that he shows up at the exact time that Boaz needs him to be there. Wow. Another coincidence? Maybe. Maybe this is God the chess player once again. So-and-so shows up. And so Boaz says to him, sit down here. He gets some other people to be witnesses. And he says, guess what, buddy? Naomi is selling her land. I don't have time to go into this. It probably isn't that Naomi is selling the land, but probably more like the rights to it. But whatever, take my word for it or don't, or talk to me later. We got way too much to cover here. So-and-so has the legal obligation to buy this land. Why this numpty hasn't stepped up yet to actually look after Naomi is another sort of question that's left unanswered for us. Why didn't he do it? Why hasn't he been stepping up so far? Where's this guy been? I don't really know. But Boaz seems to need to tell him, hey, buddy, you're first in line, so what's going on here? Step up. He says, Naomi's selling this land. You could redeem it. Redeem it. Buy it. The understanding being that land needs to be kept within the family. And so that's why there is a guy who, the closer you are to the family members means that you are the one who needs to be first in line to either buy that land back or pass it on to the next person. So Boaz is saying, you're first in line. You need to be the one to do this. And he says, okay, I'll do it. And then Boaz sort of slips it in there. Oh, yeah, and on the day that you do it, the day that you get the land, you're going to marry Ruth. Surprise, that's part of the package. Again, this is not, there's just this weird patriarchal thing going on here, and we got to wrestle with it and go, is does not necessarily equal ought, but this is the case for them, and we got to deal with what the case is for them. So you're going to get Ruth as part of the package. And the day that you get Ruth, you're going to have to basically produce an heir through Ruth. She needs to have a son, and you need to be the one to step up to do that so that the land that you just bought will go to the son. Not to your family, buddy, but to the son. And the guy goes, I can't do that. That's not, we should not be too hard on this guy. He backs out because he'd be jeopardizing what he already has with the family that he currently is responsible and entrusted with by God to look after. He's got a certain amount of money, land, and children, and his money and land are going to go to his children. But if he steps up to buy this land, what he has to do is take money from that pool, which is going to go to his children very soon. Remember, these people don't live very long. Right, life expectancy is 40-ish if you're good, if you're lucky. So they're not planning for the far distant future. This could be imminent for this guy. So he's like, I got to look after what I currently have. If I buy this land, I've got to take the money essentially out of the hands and pockets and mouths of my children in the not too distant future to buy that land, produce an heir who is going to inherit that land, and then I'm not going to get the money back. If I just buy the field, it's an investment. It's something my kids can inherit. I can lease it. I can farm it. Doesn't matter. I'm going to make money off of it long term. But not if an heir is produced. So when Boaz comes up and says, you actually have to not only buy the land, but you have to marry Ruth in order to have a child who will inherit that land in order to keep it within the family, because that's the whole point of this process, the guy goes, I can't do it. He's not a bad guy. He just doesn't go above and beyond. Same with Orpah. She's not bad. She's just not as good as Ruth. Ruth goes above and beyond. Boaz does the exact same thing. Boaz goes above and beyond what this guy does. And he says, I will make sure that this happens. So the guy passes on it, and Boaz says, all right, I'm going to get the land, and I'm going to marry Ruth. And I'm going to do it in order to produce an heir who will inherit the land. It's sacrificial. And he does it. He handles the situation, furthermore, with a fair amount of integrity. Remember, he could have tried to meddle with this thing. He had Ruth where he wanted her if he had wanted that. He doesn't. And this is their disappointing to us happily ever after. And I recognize that it sort of falls on our ears and we go, that's it? Like, this is the climax of the story? Like, Boaz is going to marry Ruth, and then they're going to have a child, and the child's going to get the land? Like, that's... I recognize that for some of us, like, we just go, this isn't quite what I was hoping for. It's not the climactic Hollywood moment that I wanted it to be. But I'm sorry, if it's disappointing to you, it was not to them. I promise you that this is, like, bigger payoff, bigger Hollywood climax than we have the ears to hear, really. This is huge, huge for them. Ruth marries Boaz, and they have a son. And this is the second and last explicit mention in the text of God doing something. The first one was that God sent bread or sent food to Bethlehem during the famine. And the next one is this. Did God make sure that these two have a son? And then we see that this scene shifts to Naomi. Naomi. This book has been at least as much about Naomi as it has been about Ruth or Boaz, because Naomi left empty. And in their view, in their world, by by this marriage, by the way that the land was redeemed, by the fact that they now have an heir, it's a son who's going to inherit it. This is the biggest possible win for Naomi. Naomi left empty, and she has been returned full, fuller than she could have possibly hoped. And God takes care of this little widow that the rest of the world had forgotten. And if her, why not you? Remember, narrative gives us not promises. If her, therefore you, gives us possibilities. It happened back then. Why not for you? Why not for you? Why would God not provide for you? Maybe he will in the ways that we hope for. The women of the town gather around Naomi and they tell her, they praise Ruth. They tell her how blessed Naomi is to have had a daughter-in-law like Ruth. Just incredible. They say, your daughter-in-law is better to you than seven sons. Highest, highest praise, compliments for Ruth, this foreigner. Nothing but high praise for Ruth through this entire story. Her sacrifice, leaving everything, family, friends, religion, culture, language, safety, and security behind in Moab for the sake of Naomi, and it paid off. They praise, we can respect and praise her bravery and her wisdom and her loyalty and her compassion. And twice in the text, she is called worthy, which in their culture is pretty much the highest compliment you can offer someone. In fact, she is recognized as worthy and praiseworthy and better than seven sons, not just by the women of this town, but by the elders of the town, by Boaz, by his field supervisor. Practically everyone in this book praises Ruth. She is the freaking Mother Teresa of the ancient world. And you should hear that. Because I've heard so many times that every biblical character is flawed except Jesus. And you know what? Not Ruth. That's awesome. Not Boaz either, by the way. But it's awesome. Not Daniel either. We're going to be in Daniel in the fall. Every person except Jesus ultimately is flawed. But these characters, as they are presented in the story, these ones are presented, Boaz and Ruth, without flaw. It's quite admirable. Quite Mother Teresa here. Just incredible. And then we get what sounds like kind of a clunk at the end of the book. We suddenly bump up against his genealogy. We're like, man, all these fathers having sons. Like, what's this all about? But if you read to the end of this list of fathers having sons, it ends with David. See, we find out at the end of that that the story has been about more than Naomi and more than Boaz and more than Ruth. It's also been about David. David, as I'm sure you know, is understood in their world to be the paragon, the pinnacle, the ultimate Israelite in every sense. The guy who is quintessentially faithful to God, the guy that everyone looks up to and wants to be like. And after David is dead and gone, they look back and they go, that was the high point for us. That's what we want again. David. And you know what we find out? David is a mudblood. Any Harry Potter fans? Harry Potter. In the Harry Potter world, there are both magical people, wizards and witches, and there are the non-magical people. And there's a particular group within the magical people who consider themselves purebloods, which means they've come from a long line of people who have all been magical, and no one ever married into their family if they didn't have magical parents. Well, non-magical parents sometimes produced magical witches and wizards. And some of those purebloods looked down on these ones that were came from non-magical families, and they called them mudbloods because they were snobs. And some of the Israelites used to do that too. And the point of the genealogy here is that by David having Moabite mudblood in his veins, it turns that very concept on its head. Very concept. If this Moabite Ruth can have the character of Mother Teresa we just talked about and produce David, who's got Moabite blood in his veins, and that very idea that we are better than other people gets flipped on its head. And suddenly there can't be this same crass distinction between outsiders and insiders and who's better than someone else. And then, of course, we know that David has one son who does look even better than him, doesn't he? We find out about that in the genealogy, once again, of Matthew, where David's great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson, Ruth's great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson is Jesus. And Jesus certainly made a mess of those outsider-insider distinctions, didn't he? Jesus would send his very disciples to all of the least of these, all of the outsiders, all of the mudbloods. That's what this is about. This might not be our version of happily ever after, but we find out that it's actually incorporated us into it, isn't it? Hasn't it? These people get more than they could have possibly dreamed. Possibly dreamed when they left Moab. Looking back, what's this story been about? It's been about God's actions in the foreground and in the background, that chess player image. It's been about God taking care of the little people. It's been about a couple of characters that actually don't look too flawed, that actually look like people that we could look up to. It looks about breaking down the distinctions between outsiders and insiders, and it is about little stories of little people being incorporated into one huge story. The story of God's people, the story of David, the story of Jesus, the story of God working in the world for the sake of the world. And if God did that with them, could he not also do it for you and incorporate your story into his much bigger story of what he is doing in the world? You could be part of that too. That's not because you are particularly special. It's because, as we have seen in the book of Ruth, God is particularly generous. Let's pray. Lord, I thank you for this picture of you that we see in Ruth. We've seen your compassion and faithfulness to those whose faith faltered because their pain overwhelmed them. We've seen your kindness and generosity modeled for us as Ruth and Boaz go above and beyond the call of duty in the service of others, just like you do. We've seen you at work in things like famine relief and the gift of children. We've considered your more hidden actions, hidden behind the scenes and coincidences that somehow you brought together so that your work would stay on track and so that the little people, the outsiders, the vulnerable would be cared for. We've seen the favor that you've shown in the way you incorporated the hated and rejected people right into the center of what you were accomplishing in Israel through David and his greater son, your son, and our Lord, Jesus. We've seen the way that you preserved a group of faithful people when the rest of the people that had called, you had called, were too busy ignoring you and spiraling out of control. Our time in this book has confirmed what Psalm 19 says, that your word revives the soul. Lord, the opportunities to distract ourselves from you never seem to decrease. In fact, we're so distracted that we sometimes doubt Psalm 19's promise that in keeping your commands there is great reward. So while we say thank you for this book of Ruth and the examples and encouragement that you have provided for us, we also confess our divided hearts. We are divided because sometimes we want to pursue lives that look like these wonderful examples, and sometimes we could care less. And it's for this reason that we come to the cross. We come remembering that Christ has given his life to repair divided hearts and rescue broken lives and show us once again that while we were your enemies, you continue to work to make us friends at the cost of your son's very life. So we come now to your communion table to remember what you have done and are doing among us. In your name, amen.